This is episode 148 of That Shakespeare Life. Today's episode is brought to you by Experience Shakespeare. Experience Shakespeare is the membership arm of That Shakespeare Life that offers you monthly digital history activity kits that let you try at home the history you learn about on the show. They work like science labs for history. Stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm Catherine Roberts-Parker, and I'm a PhD candidate in Shakespeare Studies at the University of Sydney. I'm currently writing a thesis titled Words and Music, a Study of the Cultural Significance of Ballad Singing in Elizabethan and Jacobean Comedy. Another great method for studying the life of William Shakespeare includes listening to this. It's That Shakespeare Life with my friend Cassidy Cash.
So the dramatic careers of Shakespeare and Green overlap slightly, just enough for Green to cock an eyebrow at a new actor-turned-writer appearing on the scene.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
The most memorable illustration of Robert Greene shows him dressed up as an ear of corn, sitting at a desk penning Groat's Worth of Wit, his famous deathbed insult that calls William Shakespeare an upstart crow. That upstart crow may have gone on to eclipse Robert Greene's work in posterity, but for the moment in which those lines were written about the bard, Robert Greene was not only well established as a playwright in early modern England, but held an arguably higher reputation in the playwriting industry than Shakespeare himself. Here to help us peel back the layers of history and explore the life, the work, myth, and legend of Robert Greene is our guest, Darren Freeberry-Jones. Darren Freeberry-Jones is lecturer in Shakespeare Studies at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. His role involves building and developing relationships with schools, universities, and organizations in the USA through regular teaching tours, working on the Trust's online educational resources, as well as lecturing at the Shakespeare Center. Darren's research interests include early modern attribution studies, digital approaches to examining drama, and intertextuality. His doctoral thesis examined Thomas Kidd's influence on Shakespeare's early work, and he is one of the editors for the first edition of Kidd's Collected Works since 1901. He has also investigated the boundaries of John Marston's dramatic corpus as part of the Oxford Marston Project. His recent and forthcoming work on the plays of authors such as Shakespeare, Kidd, Lyly, Marlowe, Peel, Nash, Marston, Decker, Fletcher, and others can be found in a range of peer-reviewed journals. We link to a lot of Darren's work as well as his personal website in the show notes for today's episode, so check that out if you want to read his work. Hello, Darren. Nice to have you back again with us.
Hello, Cassidy.
Did Robert Greene begin his career in London, or was he, like Shakespeare, born in some other small town before he came to the big city for his career?
It's believed that Greene was born in Norwich. In 1905, John Churton Collins proposed that Greene can be identified as the son of a saddler, someone who makes or repairs horse burnishings. Also named Robert Greene there, whilst Brenda Richardson in 1980 suggested that he was the son of an innkeeper, also hailing from Norwich, but had spent most of his adolescent life in Yorkshire. And Norwich was probably the second most populated place in Elizabethan England, with a population of around 12,000, whereas London swelled to around 200,000 by 1600. So Norwich was about 10 times the size of Stratford-upon-Avon in terms of population, and Greene may have attended the Norwich Grammar School, although this can't be confirmed, as we don't have enrollment documents for the relevant years, which is also the case with Shakespeare's attending King's New School in Stratford. The key difference between Greene and Shakespeare's backgrounds is that Greene went to university, whereas there's no record of Shakespeare attending university. Greene enrolled at St. John's College in Cambridge, but his academic performance as an undergraduate was frankly mediocre. In 1580, he took his BA graduating 38th out of 41 students in his college. And he's believed to have transferred to Clare College for his 1583 MA. And in 1588, he was granted an MA from Oxford University. And interestingly, in his pamphlet, The Repentance of Robert Green, written in the first person, Green claimed to have traveled to Italy and Spain.
So he pursued that academic life to all ends, certainly.
Yeah.
One of the things Robert Green is most remembered for is actually being a pamphleteer. But Darren, for the uninitiated, what does that mean? What does a pamphleteer do?
Well, short answer, Cassidy, a pamphleteer writes pamphlets, which are short, unbound or loosely bound booklets, and which are usually prose works, but might be interspersed with poetry or songs. And Green wrote several romances in this genre, as well as seemingly autobiographical works. After his move to London, Green published over 25 works in prose in a variety of genres. And it could be argued, actually, that Green was the first professional writer in England. A lot of Elizabethan playwrights also produced pamphlets, although Shakespeare doesn't seem to have been one of them.
Do you think that pamphlets work something like the 16th century e-book? I mean, to contextualize that for people that want to compare that to proper books or some other form of written literature, is it kind of just a smaller version of a book? There weren't any rules about what you could put in it.
I like that analogy. An e-book, as opposed to a sort of academic monograph, maybe. Yeah, I suppose that kind of saucy e-books, you know, sometimes they're romance, sometimes they're kind of Coley catching pamphlets, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I guess so. I think the analogy works, Cassidy.
While the three plays focused on in Darren's latest research are the ones whose authorship has actually been debated, Green's larger canon of work is well known. Darren, did any of Green's known works compete with Shakespeare's plays when they were first performed, such that Shakespeare and Green were competitors in the theater?
Great question, Cassidy, and a tricky one to answer. I agree with Martin Wiggins that Shakespeare probably began his dramatic writing career in 1591, whereas other scholars have argued for dates as early as 1588. Green plays like the tragedy Alphonsus, King of Aragon, the magical play Friar Bacon and Friar Bungay, and the historical romance James IV seem to have antedated Shakespeare's corpus, while Orlando Furioso, a wacky romp that Shakespeare recalled when he wrote As You Like It in 1599, is often dated 1591, and so may have overlapped with Shakespeare's Henry VI plays. Two plays I newly attribute to Green were written in the tragic genre, and most likely in 1591, and so may have provided inspiration for Shakespeare's first tragedy, Titus Andronicus. So the dramatic careers of Shakespeare and Green overlap slightly, just enough for Green to cock an eyebrow at a new actor-turned writer appearing on the scene.
Which makes his upstart crow comment really fit there, because Green is established and then here comes this kid with new stuff on the block there.
Definitely. I think he's feeling a little bit threatened in 1592.
There are three plays that have been connected with Robert Green, though concluding they were definitively authored by Green himself has remained elusive. Darren's recent research into Green's canon has produced evidence that leads Darren to conclude Green is positively the author of two of those three plays, one that is known as The Lamentable Tragedy of Locrine, or simply Locrine, and the other is called The First Part of the Most Tyrannical Tragedy and Reign of Selimus, or just Selimus for short. Darren, what evidence did you find that led you to attribute these two plays to Robert Green specifically?
Okay, I hope you and your listeners will bear with me here, Cassidy, because this might be quite a long answer.
We will batten down the hatches. We're ready.
I should put it out there that when I made the decision to examine Locrine, I was convinced that the test would point towards George Peele, Shakespeare's co-author on Titus Andronicus. But the evidence I've collected leads me to attribute that play to Green with confidence. So I examined Locrine in comparison to all authorship candidates, including Green, Peele, and Thomas Lodge. And I found that its verse style, such as its avoidance of feminine endings, that is 11th syllables concluding verse lines, like to be or not to be, that is the question, fitted into the habits of all three candidate writers I just mentioned. But that the application of a method devised by Ernst Ohrers, which involves counting all punctuation marks or pauses in verse lines, pointed away from Peel. And although such punctuation marks could be due to printers or scribes, they follow the rhythmic climate of the time and reveal remarkable consistency in same-author plays. I also found that Lacreen fitted into the ranges for Green's habit of using metrical fillers like for to and like to, meaning like. Green often used these phrases to pad out a verse line. The rates in which he used words beginning where or there, like wherein and therein, such rates being fairly consistent in attested Green plays, as well as statistical analysis of Green's unique word combinations or phrases. And for that latter test, I used an electronic database of 527 plays dated between 1552 and 1657, titled Collocations and Engrams, developed by software programmer Herbert Risby, which enables researchers to calculate which plays a text on the margins of a canon most closely resembles. And I found that the verbal fabric of Lacreen was much closer to Green's plays than any other feasible candidate dramatist. Green shared more unique phrases, by which I mean that the phrases are not to be found in any other plays of the period, with Lacreen, such as with silver stream and thunder forth revenge, than other authorial suspects. And I also discovered that Lacreen fitted neatly into the patterns for shared phraseology in all of Green's uncontested plays. And this is painstaking research,
yes,
which can make your eyes go crossed if you're not careful. But I think it's worth it when you can compile such an extensive portfolio of evidence. And I should mention, by the way, that the verbal links between Lacreen and Salimas are so copious that it's clear that both plays are largely by the same author. However, the computational results pointed towards two hands in this play, not only Green's, but also the hand of poet Thomas Lodge, whose prose tale Rosalind served as the source for Shakespeare's comedy As You Like It. Around a third of the phrases unique to Salimas and Lodge, such as woeful son and where thy master is, could be found in the space of 40 lines, while two of the unique phrases, shall the glory of your and mind inclines, occurred in the space of less than 20 lines, suggesting that these portions were contributed by Lodge. The tragedy, therefore, seems to have been a collaborative effort by Green and Lodge, and Green seems to have drawn from the language of his Lacreen during the composition of the co-author Salimas, perhaps in order to produce that play as quickly as possible while servicing a commercial operation with a large literary turnover. And the extensive passages in common between these plays would be compatible with Green's other kind of effort-saving associated with Orlando Furioso, which he notoriously sold to two different companies. On the other hand, if you'll excuse my repeated talk of hands to invoke Titus Andronicus, one of the three marginal plays long attributed to Green failed a number of statistical tests. The Robin Hood comedy, George Green, is known to have been performed in 1593. And George Buck, Master of the Revels, recorded on the play's title page that Edward Juby, an actor, believed the play to have been written by Green, whereas Shakespeare couldn't recall the author's name.
Convenient.
Well, yes, Well, that is quite funny, actually. Whenever it comes to any kind of documentary evidence of Shakespeare in court or anyone relying on his testimony, he seems to have a very poor memory. But anyway, he couldn't recall the author's name, but told Buck that whoever wrote it was a minister who took the principal role for himself. And the attribution to Green could be a title-inspired guess. Shakespeare might very well have been right. I found that Georgia Green was quite unlike Green's accepted plays in terms of its versatile and linguistic habits, and ranked very low when it came to numerical figures for shared phrases between all plays attributed to Green.
To me, it's a lot like pointillism, putting this all together just one point at a time to then paint this huge picture. And it's amazing to me what you're able to accomplish with technology and this extreme analysis. If you're interested in collocations and engrams, we will link to that in the show notes for today's episode so you can take a look at some of the technology that went into drawing these conclusions. Thomas Creed in 1595 described Locrine as, quote, newly set forth, overseen, and corrected by W.S., end quote. When I saw the W.S. on that description for the first time, I desperately wanted those initials to stand for William Shakespeare, as you might expect from me, of course. However, several noted scholars, including Darren, have concluded that attribution is unlikely, if not impossible. Darren, why has this theory that the W.S. on Locrine could have been Shakespeare now been disproven?
Well, the main theory is that Shakespeare might have had a revising hand in this play. But if he did, his contributions are so minimal as to evade rigorous statistical testing. None of the tests I ran provided any evidence for Shakespeare's hand. And so I agree with scholar Will Sharp that Shakespeare is an almost impossible candidate based on the stylistic qualities of Locrine compared with his acknowledged works. The epilogue to the play appears to have been written later than the original text, as it alludes to Elizabeth I having reigned for 38 years. She ascended the throne on November 17th, 1558. And the original play is usually dated 1591. So W.S. may have written the epilogue in or around 1595, but the verse style and phraseology of that epilogue is utterly unlike Shakespeare. Disproven is a strong word, but I think we could safely reject Shakespeare as a feasible candidate. Maybe W.S. was someone who shared the same initials as Shakespeare. Shakespeare's name didn't appear on the title page of a play until 1598, when quartos of Richard II, Richard III, and Love's Labour's Lost were printed. Locrine was included in Shakespeare's 1664 third folio, a copy of which is kept by the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust. But of the seven texts added to that edition, only Pericles contained Shakespeare's hand. Later publishers recognized the marketing potential of Shakespeare's name, I think. For instance, William Rowley wrote a play called The Birth of Merlin, in which the eponymous character is born with magic powers, the ability to speak, and a fully grown beard. Something I didn't achieve until at least the age of eight. And the 1662 quarto attribution of The Birth of Merlin to Shakespeare is demonstrably wrong. Licensed as a new play in 1622, there aren't many things I would put past Shakespeare, but writing beyond the grave is probably one of them. So we can't always put too much emphasis on title page attributions.
Darren's work mentions that the first part of the most tyrannical tragedy and reign of Salimus was performed by the Queensmen in 1592. Darren, was Shakespeare with the Queensmen for this performance?
It's possible that Shakespeare was a member of the Queensmen playing company, but I consider it most likely that Shakespeare began his career as an actor dramatist for Pembroke's men, as proposed by J.O. Halliwell Phillips during the 19th century. And judging by quarto title pages, Shakespeare seems to have written his earliest plays, such as Henry VI Part III, The Taming of the Shrew, and Titus Andronicus, with Pembroke's men before it disbanded in 1593. A.S. Cairncross argued that Pembroke's men existed before 1592, probably as early as 1589, and that it was Shakespeare's company. And similarly, Terence Schoon Yongan notes that surviving evidence linking Shakespeare's early acting career with Pembroke's Men is more plentiful than surviving evidence for some of its fellow playing companies. So Greene and Shakespeare seem to have been writing for rival playing companies, although I think too much emphasis can be placed on the notion of rivalry. The London theatres existed in a narrow and frequently competitive world, but also a collaborative world in many respects. Now, Shakespeare might very well have attended performances of Queen's Men plays. He certainly knew plays produced by that company well, such as the True Tragedy of Richard III, the famous Victories of Henry V, and the Troublesome Reign of King John, even adapting some of these texts later in his career. But there's a lot of conjecture involved when we think of Shakespeare's playing company prior to joining Lord Chamberlain's Men around 1594.
Darren's research is groundbreaking in its impressive analysis of a minutia of detail into the text of Robert Greene, including calculations that look at the percentage of syllables present, pause patterns that we've mentioned, as well as the number of feminine endings that form this kind of textual signature by the author in a style that they use to write plays. Darren, you've gone over what the analysis was and these particular details that you found, but I'm curious if this kind of textual stamp was intentional by the author when it was written, or if it's kind of a posthumous analysis that functions like maybe the science of linguistics, where the writer, in this case Robert Greene, may not have necessarily been aware of his own patterns despite the ability to define them today.
Well, that's a fantastic question. I remember giving a talk on attribution methods at the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust event called Winter School, and someone coming up to me afterwards and asking if I could fake a Shakespeare play, given my knowledge of his writing habits. But I defy anyone to try and write a play in which they can ensure that verse habits, linguistic habits, and phraseology fit into the expectations for any writer of the Elizabethan period. You might catch one quantifiable element of a writer's style, but a plurality of methods will identify a known author of a work beyond reasonable doubt, even if a play is plagiaristic or deeply influenced by another writer's style. Writers like Greene couldn't begin to conceive of the kind of linguistic tests that scholars now run on their texts. And attribution scholars often try to identify sub-stylistic markers. But of course, we can't claim outright that any element of a dramatist's work is unconscious. I've actually run plagiarism software on my own creative writing, and I discovered many instances of self-repetition of my own. The phrase splashes of colour crops up several times in things I've written, and I wasn't even aware that this formed part of my lexicon. And the most striking word combination in my works, the plagiarism software highlighted, was like something from a beautiful dream or nightmare, which is even so much a phrase as a whole sentence. And I wasn't even conscious that I recycled such phrases. So they seem to operate below the level of conscious thought. So no, I don't think writers like Greene would have been conscious of all of their linguistic patterns. They certainly wouldn't have been able to quantify them like we can today, and wouldn't have been aware of the statistical ranges for each of their writing habits.
Now, I know we've identified that it's possible Shakespeare would have seen plays by the Queen's Men and sort of been in places that Robert Greene was, but do we know of any incidents between Robert Greene and William Shakespeare that would have precipitated the growth's worth of wit? I mean, was there anything in particular that happened to make Robert Greene annoyed with Shakespeare, or was it just that he's this new kid on the block?
Not really. I think Greene, as a university-educated dramatist, was a bit alarmed that actors suddenly didn't need him anymore. So players, or puppets, as Greene calls them, like Shakespeare, could now write their own plays. And many scholars suggest that Greene is making an accusation of plagiarism against Shakespeare. But I think he's saying that Shakespeare learned his craft through acting in the plays of what George Saintsbury called the university wits. Writers like Christopher Marlowe, Thomas Nash, and George Peele. Shakespeare beautifies himself in their feathers because he's delivered their words on stage and he's learning what audiences like and don't like in terms of language, verse, and dramatic devices. I actually think Shakespeare's intimate knowledge of the stage from having started off as an actor gave him an advantage over his Elizabethan contemporaries because his plays are deeply actor and audience conscious. I should mention actually that in a 2017 essay published in Review of English Studies titled Upstart Crow, The Myth of Shakespeare's Plagiarism, Brian Vickers examines all the writings of Greene in which he criticizes the actors, showing that he repeats over and over in very similar terms the same basic accusation that they depend on the playwrights yet unjustly enjoy more prestige and financial reward.
So how did Shakespeare respond when this was published? Do we know if Shakespeare penned any kind of public response to Robert Greene?
There's a fascinating 2005 article in Early Theatre Journal called Plucking a Crow in the Comedy of Errors. I had to be careful with my tongue there, Cassidy. In which Maureen Godman argues that Dromio of Ephesus's lines, a crow without feather, master mean you so, if a crow help us in, sirrah, we'll pluck a crow together, is a swipe of Greene. Dromio is referring to a crowbar in the Comedy of Errors to be used to break open a gate. But it could be an allusion to Shakespeare breaking into a dramatic writing career. And some scholars think Polonius's line, that's an ill phrase, a vile phrase, beautified in Hamlet, alludes to Greene's claim that Shakespeare was beautified in the feathers of better educated dramatists. All we can say for certain, Cassidy, in terms of Shakespeare responding to Greene in some way, is that Shakespeare used Greene's prose romance Pandosto as a source for his The Winter's Tale.
Which is really the best response to criticism professionally, I think. Just go forward and be successful anyway. So when did Robert Greene's life end? Where did he end up? How did he die?
Greene died on the 3rd of September of 1592, probably aged 34. And his death and burial were announced by Gabriel Harvey, who attributed Greene's demise to a surfeit of pickled herring and Rhenish wine.
So at a party.
Well, a bit like Shakespeare, I suppose. Shakespeare supposedly dies during a merry meeting with fellow writers Ben Jonson and Michael Drayton.
Where was he buried? Do we have a grave site for Robert Greene that can be visited today?
Gabriel Harvey claimed Greene had been buried in the new churchyard near Bedlam on the 4th of September, but no record of Greene's burial has been found. And so, unfortunately, like so many Elizabethan dramatists, Cassidy, people can't visit his gravesite.
Well, I know we would love to explore the life of Robert Greene further and learn more about him and his plays. Darren, what are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
The most sustained work on Robert Greene in recent years is probably Writing Robert Greene, Essays on England's First Notorious Professional Writer, which was edited by Kirk Melnikov and Edward Geesks in 2008. And readers interested in the chronology of Greene's plays, as well as every other dramatist's works, should consult the seminal volumes produced by Martin Wiggins, in association with Catherine Richardson, British Drama 1533 to 1642, a catalogue. Now, there hasn't been an edition of Greene's works since the early 20th century, and it's an aspiration of mine to edit a collection of his plays one day. Readers seeking to consult Greene's works can check out Alexander Dyce's 1831 edition, or A.B. Grossart, produced between 1881 and 1886, Chirton Collins's in 1905, or most recently, T.H. Dickinson's in 1909 as part of the Mermaid series. There's also plenty of information on Shakespeare and Green on the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust website at shakespeare.org.uk.
We will link to all of these resources in today's episode, as well as where you can read Darren's work and check into the research we've been discussing today. So make sure you visit the show notes to find direct links to those. Now, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and Darren is in the unique position of having been on our show a few times now. So Darren, you get the opportunity to choose a new book here. But the question is, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
Yeah, as a repeat guest, I find I'm ransacking my library.
You're going to have a library on your desert island now, yes.
In line with the topic, I think I'll have to go with the book that got me hooked on attribution and textual studies, Brian Vickers's 2002 monograph, Shakespeare Co-Author, in which Vickers explores the histories of attributions of Shakespeare's collaborative plays and synthesizes all of the evidence. It's a magisterial work and remains, in my view, the finest book ever produced in the field.
We will link to Brian Vickers' monograph in the show notes for today as well. So, Darren, what's next for you now that you've conquered the minutiae of detail in Green's plays? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
I'm working on the canon of John Fletcher, which is a huge undertaking, trying to distinguish the different collaborators in the Beaumont and Fletcher folios. And I think I've identified the writer who finished off Fletcher's last play after he died, The Noble Gentleman, as none other than John Ford, most famous for the madcap tragedy, 'Tis Pity She's a Whore. And my research findings on The Noble Gentleman will be published in the peer-reviewed journal Studia Metrica e Poetica. And I'm also working on a lot of online lectures at the moment with the Shakespeare Birthplace Trust, including a lecture on the different methods used in attribution studies. And if listeners interested in sharing these lectures with their students or checking them out themselves can contact me at darren.freebury-jones@shakespeare.org.uk.
Wonderful. Well, we'll link to where you can find those lectures on the show notes for today's episode, so you can definitely attend and share those. Darren, thank you so much for being back with us again today and sharing the history of Robert Greene. This has been fun. Thank you so much.
Pleasure as always, Cassie. Thank you so much.
As always, more history is packed into the show notes of the episode. Find links to more information on Robert Greene, including links to Collocation and Ingrams, the software program Darren used in his research for Greene's plays, as well as links to Darren's blog, where you can read his research, as well as connect with Darren to find out about the upcoming lectures he has going on and how to attend those. Find all of this history, links, and more inside the show notes at CassidyCash.com/episode 148. That's CassidyCash.com/EP 148. Don't forget that the video version is now streaming on YouTube, so you can watch the episode of Darren and I talking about Robert Greene at youtube.com/C/CassidyCash. And if you would like to have all the video versions of our show, along with documentaries, animated plays, and more playable on your tablet, desktop, or phone, be sure to check out the digital streaming app for That Shakespeare Life, where you can find all the video versions of our podcast at CassidyCash.com/experience. That's CassidyCash.com/experience. That's it for this week. Thank you for being here. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.